shows that we had at Neil's Yard. So we recorded all those on mini disc, and I think we've got Jeff Buckley, PJ Harvey, people like that, all on mini disc somewhere. But I don't know what we're going to do with them.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Promote the Hell Out of It. My name is Misael Trujillo, and this is the podcast where I talk to people worth promoting about subjects we should all be talking about. And this is episode 30, which I am so excited to release. The past year has been absolutely great. We've had so many good guests on the show. I've personally learned so much. And I would love to know what your favorite episode has been so far, or what piece of information you found the most useful. But I am really excited to share today's guest with you because I talked to Nigel House, one of the owners of Rough Trade. And if you are a lover of music, or if you live in London, no doubt you will know of Rough Trade, and if not, go search them. And I am sure you will love this conversation, regardless of knowing about them or not, because it is really a legendary shop that's got so much history in London and has done so much for the music culture. We talk about working in the shop in the 80s, taking it over the same year that Nigel started working in the shop, opening up a hell of a lot of shops, some of which have closed down since. We also talk about the birth of Slam City Skates. Basically, it is an incredible conversation that spans the last 40 years, and there's some incredible gems in there that I think a lot of you will really, really enjoy. So I would love to hear from you all what you think, and any questions you have, please send them my way. This episode is sponsored by our great friends at Nextstand. They provide great quality laptop stands that are super portable. They've helped me loads. They've helped the podcast load, but specifically the actual products are really useful for the work I do, for being remote, traveling around all the time, and needing to prop my laptop up and do some editing without my back hurting. So yeah, go check them out. You get a cheeky discount code for being a listener of this podcast. And without any further ado, here is my conversation with the wonderful Nigel House. Nigel, I am so happy to have you on the show. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I am doing really good. So I was watching an interview you did, and I think it was with PRS, and you mentioned that you moved into London in the 70s. Is that right?
Yeah, I come from... I was brought up on a farm in Somerset, and 1976, punk rock was happening, and I was desperate to get to London. So I chose my university purely because of going to London and punk rock.
That's amazing. I think I did something pretty similar when I moved to London too. following the punk rock scene, absolutely. Yes. Were you already a fan of Rough Trade growing into London then?
You know what, I suppose at that time the shop started in 76, so I didn't really know about it. I used to buy all my records in a shop in Bath. And it's only when I started at uni in 76 and then restarted in 77. And that's when I started going to the shop at first. And that was when it was on Kensington Park Road.
How quickly did that shop that change then? Because you must have seen it grow into something much bigger in quite a short period of time.
Well, I suppose when you're sort of not part of it, you don't really see what happens. I suppose all I saw was just the shop, and I used to go in there, all the time. I spent, in those days we got a grant, so I used to be able to go in there and I spent all my grant money on records, and eventually they offered me a job there.
That's amazing. Yes. I was going to say, when I moved into London, there's a lot of months that I struggled paying rent at the end of the month, but I had a nice collection of Rough Trade records to, yes, to show for it, so I can relate. Can you, yes, remember any of those first records that you bought at Rough Trade?
Oh, God, yeah. All those kind of early, I suppose my peak period was after the punk thing. I suppose it was more the post-punk thing. So all the pop group, the Slits, the Subway Sect, the Fire Engines, all those, classic Factory, Rough Trade, labels like that, they were just so great. Every record they put out seemed to be such a great record and such a statement those days.
Yeah, and it's so nice, like at any point in history you can go and there's such a good collection of records that you can discover, and that's the beauty, I think, of something like Rough Trade, is then having all these artists that you can go through that you didn't know about before.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's still great today. I don't want you thinking that it was better back then. I suppose it's just, when you're young, you know, it just means that bit more to you, I suppose. But I mean, I still find records today that I just fall in love with straight away, and they're just as important to me as some of those, you know, pop group records or Slits records or Gang of Four records.
As we're on the subject, I was going to touch on it a bit later, but I think it's interesting because for me, the styles of music that are releasing something important have changed over time, and at least the records I enjoy have gone from punk records that were very political to, I find recently, a lot of the UK hip-hop records are very political and strong and have a great message.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one sort of, not disappointing thing, but you'd have hoped in times like this there'd be a bit more political music, or sort of political guitar music, I should say, because you're right, the sort of the hip-hop and the grime scenes are very political. Not necessarily in an overtly, you know, big P way, but I just think, yeah, a bit more politics would be great. I mean, I know when there was the Iraq war and Neil Young put out a record and he said, you know, I've been waiting for, you know, one of the young groups to put out an anti-war record, and none of them have, so I've done it. And it wasn't a great record, but, you know, fair play to him, he did it, you know, and I just think, I would just wish there was a bit more of that, really.
I've found a bit of a disheartenment in the punk scene for me. I was so close to it, but because I like the political aspect, I like the fact that it talked about important messages, and I find it lacking sometimes, and it's sad. But I think that changes, and it is nice to see, like I say, the hip-hop community kind of taking over that mantle a bit recently.
Yeah, I mean, look at Stormzy getting involved in the election. I mean, these days, I think it's quite hard, well, it's not hard, but I mean, I think artists are very wary of putting their head above the parapet and saying something which, you know, you or I might not think is controversial, but, you know, Michael Gove picked up on it. I mean, it's great that Stormzy is using his position. He's not really worrying that much about selling records, because that can often put people off. You know, if you say something very political, yeah, put off. You think of the Dixie Chicks and George Bush. But it's great to see Stormzy doing that, really great.
And I think it's interesting how it's affecting the younger generation, because I think, like, Stormzy obviously, like, took a lot from Giggs and people like that. But now seeing Slow Tie, for example, the way he's talking, and Dave, the way he's talking, I think it's like, it's accepted to talk about politics, and it's accepted to be interested in how the country's voting. And that's really good to see.
Yes, it is. I mean, I suppose with Dave and Slow, mind you, with Dave, he sold a lot of records as well, but I suppose Stormzy, he's that level above, isn't he? He's a huge person, and it's great to see somebody who's so mainstream talking about politics. It's really great to see that.
And how do you feel, you say you started working, they offered you a job in the 80s, yeah. How was politics a part of the conversations that were happening in the shop? How important was it at that time?
I mean, you know, it just seems to me that back then, politics was that much more important. I suppose it was the time of Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think people were just so anti-Thatcher. She was so divisive. And you think, I mean, I think of the pop group, and you think of the Specials and Ghost Town. And I suppose it affected young people so much. I mean, it does now, but I just don't quite see why. I mean, maybe people are just quite happy, you know, getting sucked into their, you know, the internet and the mobile phones, and they kind of just, you know, don't look out so much. Whereas in those days, maybe we did look out a bit more.
Absolutely. And do you think there was also an element of fear? Because I think that a lot of people go on the internet, like you say, and lash out on the internet. But obviously, in the 80s, you've got like the Skins in Ladbroke, for example,
yes.
Things like that. Did that kind of put a different element of how you act?
I can remember I was doing security at a Mekons gig at Yulu, and the Ladbroke Grove Skins turned up, and they said, "We're coming in." And I said, "No, you're not." And one of them just nutted the door, and I said, "Okay, in you come." But we did used to have a security man on the door at Kensington Park Road, because the skinheads sort of came along. But in the end, it was, I suppose, it was fairly, it wasn't a huge problem. I mean, I remember going to a Sham 69 gig at LSE, and blimey, that was, you know, quite scary. And
I can imagine.
I think Jimmy Percy and The Clash did play together, didn't they, to try and calm things down at the time. They played at the Victoria Park March, I think it was Victoria Park, and they played together to try and sort of, you know, punks and skins. I mean, after all, it's all the same thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was God, it was pretty sketchy sometime with the skinheads, I can tell you. And, of course, with the specials and madness, they didn't... It was a strange kind of relationship, I think, with specials and madness and had with the skins, because they took so much iconography from the skinheads, but then they didn't, you know, the right-wing side of things they didn't like at all, especially, you know, well, none of them liked it at all.
Yeah, and I think that's been pretty important for Rough Trade the whole time, is that it was quite obvious it was attracting left-leaning people, would you say?
Oh, yeah, of course, yes.
Yeah, and how did that affect how careful you had to be with the choices you made? Like the bands, how you needed to know the bands and what they were singing about and what they were into politically?
Well, that's a tricky subject, isn't it? You know, it's always been a bit of a grey area, I suppose. I mean, you look at some of the iconography that, you know, Throbbing Gristle used, or Lie Buck, or even The Birthday Party, you know, and Death in June, and the use of totalitarian imagery, and people played with it a lot. And personally, you know, I think you have to be careful where you go with that. I don't really like banning records from the shop because they don't happen to. I don't happen to agree with them politically. I mean, obviously, groups like Screwdriver, and that, you know, they were an overtly fascist band. Obviously, you shouldn't, you know, we'd never stop those. But somebody like Lie Buck, you know, it's a very much a grey area. There was other sort of right-wing bands as well. The whole Oi! Movement and Gary Bushell, that was always a bit of a sort of a grey area. But, I mean, they just weren't very popular for us, I suppose. So we didn't have that problem, really.
Yeah, of course. And I guess that's the positive side of the community you'd built, that those records are automatically not going to do well because you've put yourself in that position.
Yes, exactly. I mean, with something like Burzum, who are, you know, part of the sort of Norwegian death metal scene, personally, I don't like stocking them. Some people really like them, so we stock them, but we don't really sell them or promote them. They're just in the racks. I suppose you've got to give people the choice, I suppose. It's a really grey area where you go now. See, it's very tricky.
Of course. So let's talk a little bit about 1982 and when everything kind of changed from your being an employee. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened?
Yeah, I mean, there's the three of us. It was me, Pete and Judith. I've been there for about 6 months, I guess, maybe a year. And Rough Trade, the shop was there, but there was a label, the distribution, and it was getting really big. And I guess the accountants looked at all the books and said to Jeff Travis, who started the shop, well, look, the shop's not making any money, we're going to shut it. And Jeff wasn't very happy about that, but the three of us in the shop said, OK, we'll buy it from you. And it kind of suited us and it suited him because, you know, he knew he could trust us with the shop. And indeed, we still see him. We're still very, you know, close to each other. So, the three of us bought the shop from him. And, you know, I remember when we first started, we went to the bank, and we had £5,000 between us, and the bank lent us £5,000, so that's how we got going. And we used to pay ourselves, you know, what you'd get on the dole, which in those days in London, I mean, it's hard to imagine, but you know, the price of everything in London these days. But in those days, you could live quite reasonably on the dole and work. So we had a great time. And, you know, we were young, I suppose, what was I, 22, 23. No kids, no mortgage. You know, we thought, look, come on, let's just do it. So we did.
That's amazing. And what was the reality? What was the first hurdle you had to get over, for example, when you actually took that on?
Well, the first thing we had to do, we were in Kensington Park Road, but the landlord, because we didn't have any assets of any note to put behind it, we had to move the shop. So we moved just around the corner to Talbot Road, 130 Talbot Road. And in fact, that's probably a better location than Kensington Park Road. So we moved there. And I know it was just before Carnival. And the first weekend we opened, it was Carnival. And somebody broke in and nicked our speaker. We had these really lovely big Tannoy speakers. And somebody broke in and nicked the speakers, which is a really, you know, depressing thing.
Yeah, of course.
And so for the first few, I can't remember how long, for the first few weeks or months, we used to play music via a beatbox, like one of those big cassette players. But, you know, it soon got back onto track. But that was, you know, we had to learn quite fast, I tell you.
I can imagine. And what about the relationship you had with Rough Trade Records? Was that something, did they help you and like kind of mentor you, or were you left to your own devices at that time?
We were kind of left to our own devices, but because we had such a great relationship with Jeff and still do, they made it very easy for us. So the warehouse at that time was down on Blenheim Crescent. At the end of Blenheim Crescent, they had a warehouse there. And so they used to let us go down there, pick all the records that we wanted, whenever we wanted. And we got really good terms with them. It was still a very sort of, you know, punk rock relationship that, you know, we looked after ourselves, but they made sure that we were looked after, you know, good terms. And if we were a bit late paying, that was fine. So no, it was great. It was great. You know, they've always looked after us, really.
And we've talked a lot about the punk side of things, but something that I love about Rough Trade is the reggae side of things and what you did for the black community in London, the Caribbean community. How did that affect like the shop and the clientele and the kind of culture that was created?
Well, I suppose it was because I suppose punks and sort of rastas or yeah, sort of reggae music were all outsiders at the time. And I remember listening to Johnny Rotten on Capital Radio, and I think he played Dr. Alain Mantado, Born for a Purpose or Reason for a Living. And that's kind of what got me into reggae. And that whole punky reggae party with Don Letts, you know, playing at the Roxy, yeah, and all that sort of thing. So that kind of brought everybody together. And I suppose, you know, reggae, that's just such an interest. At that time was such a great, so interesting. And then Johnny Rotten started the Frontline label with Virgin sort of backing. So it kind of brought it all together, I suppose. I mean, we've always thought in the shop that, you know, we sell two sorts of music, sort of good music and bad. There's two sorts of music. We only sell one sort of good music. And I suppose at the time, reggae was so sort of, you know, important to us. I mean, we all loved it and still do. And I just remember, you know, Bob Marley, great man, but we didn't used to sell many of his records, but, you know, Culture, 2 Sevens Clash, I mean, it sold loads of copies then. We still sell loads of copies now. The Congos, all that kind of mid to late 70s and the sort of the vocals and the toasting and the dub records. I mean, to me, that's the peak period of reggae. And I think it's coming back a bit as well, so that's really great.
Yeah, I love that. We just spent some time in Asia, and the reggae scene there is alive and thriving. We watched a lot of very good reggae bands, yeah, which isn't what you expect when you're in Thailand.
No, I know Don Letts. I mean, he says whenever he does sort of shows, he says, you know, at the moment there's lots of white kids there, but not many black kids. but, you know, just hope that will change and sort of come back round again. I'm sure it will. I mean, I think so. Yeah, you need to think of sort of Protégé and Chronix and Coffee. I think there's some really interesting sort of artists out there who are getting back to the kind of the old school and the less sort of slack style of music, I suppose.
And how about the live event side of things? Because when you originally took on the shop, you weren't doing gigs, were you?
Well, that's not to start off with. I mean, we've always done events in the shop. So we had, I think the first one we ever did was the Violent Femmes. They did an album on Slash and American, Rough Trade put it out in the UK, and they busked outside Talbot Road. So that must have been quite early on, 84, 85, I guess.
Oh, amazing.
And we also had Suicidal Tendencies. At the time when we were selling skateboards, we had Suicidal Tendencies in the shop doing a signing, so they're signing records and signing skateboards, cool. And that was crazy. But so these days, I mean, we do events in all the shops, really, and it's such a great way of getting people involved in the shop and, you know, bands with their audiences and, you know, selling records or CDs as well. I mean, it's everybody likes them, and it just brings people in. Obviously, I mean, from our point of view, it brings people in, and it's not just bands playing. We love to do, you know, Q&As, film screenings, book events, you know, anything really. It's just, I suppose we see these days it's not just about music, it's about being part of a, I hate to use the term, but a cultural hub, and you want to be part of the whole sort of thing that's going on, I suppose.
Yeah, I think it's really important with how we listen to music in this day and era to have a physical element, something where you go and you connect to that music. How have you found that things like the streaming culture, have affected how people actually connect to the music, buy music, go to gigs?
You know, there's been so much change in the music world since I've been doing it that, you know, you just have to embrace these things. There's no point saying, oh, it's a bad thing. You just have to, it is what it is. So you just have to embrace it. I mean, for me, streaming, I mean, I don't really do it. I suppose I listen to things on YouTube now and again to see what they're like. But I mean, I think it's a way of people being able to check things out, see what it's like. And if they, I think for our customers, they'll have a listen. If they really like it, they'll buy it. And if they don't, they won't, you know. And I think there's just going to be levels of, you know, levels of interest. And I think, you know, things go going to go right across. So, you know, you stream it, oh, that's okay. Well, you stream it, that's pretty good. I'll buy the CD of that, £10, okay. Oh, well, I'll stream it, oh, yeah, I love this. I'm going to go buy the vinyl on this, £20. You know, I think it's going to be a mix and match culture. You know, you just, you know, different prices on different things, I think, really.
And what about those events that get kids into the shops, the younger generations into the shops, and actually looking through vinyl? How important is that to business in general?
Well, it's incredibly important. You know, we've got to make sure that we keep, you know, a new generation, you know, we want to get them hooked on music in the same way that I was. And I think there's two things here. You know, you've got to make it exciting. I mean, for any retailer, you've got to make it exciting, really. Make the whole experience of being not just, otherwise you can just click and buy. So you make it exciting by having events. But also, I mean, I remember one record store day, there was a One Direction picture disc came out. And, you know, some people in the shops were saying, well, we're not going to stock that, obviously. And I say, well, actually, I think we should stock it, because I think that will get in a new audience. There'll be these kids coming in, and they'll come in and they'll see, wow, who's Blondie? You know, who's The Clash? Yeah. You know, let me check them out. And they get into the whole culture of, you know, of record shops and music and sort of interesting things like that. And I remember that record store day, we sold all the One Direction singles we had. And I remember a father and daughter coming up, and he wanted a Frank Zappa thing and she wanted the One Direction. What a great combination.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And, you know, I know that somebody, Tallulah, she was in the queue once for record store day buying something, and now she works for us. You know, it's. I mean, you just got to get these sort of young people in, and, you know, if they like One Direction, that's fine. You know, they can move on to something else. We've all had sort of things in the past that you sort of think, oh, really, do I like that?
No, I think it's really interesting, and I feel like there tends to be a bit of negativity with people that love music about certain types of music or artists,
yeah.
And we forget that they are entryways into discovering everything else, and they have their place, and they're incredibly important, because without them, I wouldn't have discovered bands that I love, like Creedence Clearwater Revival and bands like that. I only got into them through really rubbish pop punk type music that I listened to when I was younger.
Yeah, somebody doing a cover of Bad Moon Rising or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, exactly. I'm pretty sure that's exactly it.
Yeah. But, you know, I firmly believe there's no such thing as a guilty pleasure. There's lots of great music out there, and, you know, you like it one day and the next day you might not like it, but, you know, so what? You know, there's you know, different sorts of music. It fulfills different sorts of functions, really. And, you know, if it's a Katy Perry single, there's nothing wrong with loving a Katy Perry single. You might not want to own it. You might want to stream it a million times in the first couple of days. But, you know, great. I mean, I think, you know, just listen to what you love, I think.
Exactly. And talking about change, do you think that vinyl ever actually disappeared? And will CDs become extinct?
Vinyl never disappeared. I mean, I can remember, I'm so old that I remember when CDs first came in, and there was people saying, right, let's stop selling vinyl. Nobody wants it anymore. And, you know, I just was saying, well, no, people do want it. Funnily enough, the thing that kept vinyl going was the were Dance 12 inches. So it was at the time of sort of the Underworld, Chemical Brothers, Orbital, people like that. And they were doing these kind of underground 12s, sort of early acid house, I suppose. And we used to sell so much of that. And that's what kept vinyl going for us, because people still wanted it. And there's that period when music did stop coming out of vinyl, CD only. Now, it's, you know, it's, so we've always sold it. And now it's come back in such a huge way.
Yeah.
But we still sell CDs. People still want them. And it's, you know, I have to say it's a source of slight frustration for me that people say, oh, you know, CDs are dead, nobody wants them. But in actual fact, people do want them. And I think that, you know, for their price, they're a great thing. I mean, I think that people are still going to buy them because, you know, some people want physical product on everything. Personally, I'd rather get a CD than stream something. So, you know, then you can file it away. And I do have people saying to me now, right, let's get rid of CDs, let's stop selling them. And you see these new shops opening and they're selling only vinyl. And it's a format. I mean, what's going to happen when vinyl is not fashionable anymore? Because it is fashionable at the moment. And that kind of does worry me because it's so faddy. And you just know what happens with fashions. They come in and out of fashion. So, you know, these shops are going to be stuck with vinyl and not selling anything else. So CDs for me aren't dead. I mean, I still really like them.
What about when mini discs came out? Would you have bet on them?
No. I mean, there's a lot of formats out there that have disappeared. You know, what are those big video discs or whatever they were?
Oh,
mini discs. And I don't think you can even get a mini disc. I think stuff that's been put on mini disc players, I don't think you can even play them anymore. So a lot of information has been lost somewhere along the line.
But, a lot of money's been lost.
Yes, exactly, yeah. And, you know, 8-track cartridges, you know.
Yeah.
Blimey.
Are there any that you miss? Any that you actually wish had done well?
God, no, not really. Not that I can think of. I suppose mini discs were quite good for recording things, though, weren't they? We recorded loads of the shows that we had at Neil's Yard. So we recorded all those on mini disc, and I think we've got, you know, Jeff Buckley, you know, PJ Harvey, people like that, all on mini disc somewhere. But I don't know what we're going to do with them.
It was a timing thing with mini discs. They were really good, and you could fit a lot on them.
Yeah.
But then obviously the iPod came out, and the MP3s came out. Like, it seems, in my memory, like a week or two after the mini disc did.
Yeah, I know. It's funny. Things happen like that, don't you think, of the difference between Betamax and VHS? And Betamax, you know, videos were miles better format in way, in quality and things like that, but VHS just had more people behind it, and it worked better. It's not necessarily the quality of the actual technology that made it work. It's funny how these things work out sometimes.
Yeah, it's true. We mentioned the skate stuff that you were selling when Suicidal Tendencies were there. What was the skate scene like in London at that time? What made you decide to start stocking skate stuff?
Well, what happened was just shortly after, yes, it must have been after we took over the shop. Well, I suppose actually when we were in the shop, when it's still part of Rough Trade, we used to buy records from Rough Trade America, who were based in the west coast of America. We used to bring in, you know, Black Flag, Husker Du, Minutemen, DRI, Suicidal Tendencies. We also used to bring in Thrasher magazine, and also they did a series of cassettes, skate rock cassettes, and there was this whole, you know, interlink between skate culture and punk culture. So we used to bring it all in, and then we sort of realised that actually nowhere in this country was selling skateboards, so we started bringing skateboards as well. And all the American, or not all the Americans, but a lot of Americans from the bases up in Suffolk other places used to come into London on a Saturday. And we used to have crazy Saturdays with, you know, kids coming in buying music, but also Americans coming in buying skateboards, decks, and then Thrasher. I mean, it used to be such great fun. We'd get in a shipment of records from America. It would be literally cracking open the boxes, and there'd be another amazing record coming out, Husker Du, Zen Arcade, you know, Black Flag, Damaged, and people were just buying them out of the box, and that that excitement was fantastic. I remember it, you know, still now, and it's, you know, there's lessons to be learned from that. You know, you have to sort of try and make that, you know, that excitement, you still have to try and make that excitement now and make it fun for people, and, you know, bringing it back. I do think the internet's a great thing in many ways, but I do think it's kind of taken the fun and excitement out of music, in that you can, you know, you can see anything immediately. You know, if you hear about a new band, you can just click on the old Google, have a look and sort of listen to it, 30 seconds, yeah, it's all right, you know, and then move on to the next scene. And I do think there's definitely something to be said for bands trying to stay off it in a way, so they're not so readily accessible. I mean, I think Black Midi, for instance, at the moment, I think they're really good at doing that sort of thing. It's just making it a bit more underground, a bit more counterculture, a bit more fun, I think, really.
It's interesting because the reason I'm so passionate about music is because it wasn't as accessible on the internet. And we're talking at a time when if you did want to get a song off the internet, it would take so long to get anyway that there was no point because the internet connection was so bad.
Yes.
So you'd go into the store and you'd ask someone for a recommendation. And we said it the other day that you miss that now. You don't. It's not the same a computer giving you a recommendation than someone who you trust, who's already recommended you 10 records that you love. You get excited by that, and you have a connection with someone, and you almost build a friendship over the excitement you get from buying something.
Oh, yeah, I mean, that's part of the whole sort of shop, you know, music shop culture, and I think all good shops do that, and we've always tried to do that. I mean, I've got, you know, customers that I've sold music to over, you know, 40 years who I still see and I go and see and we still sort of hang out together, but you know, they started off as customers, now I guess they're friends, you know. And you know, one day I was in the Portobello Road shop and you know, a dad came in with his son and his grandson, and it's just like three, I mean, he's only a little baby obviously, but you know, to see all these people coming back and saying, oh, what have you got this week, anything good this week, you know, you have got to, you know, make sure you keep those connections going, otherwise, you know, it's a slippery slope, I think.
And when you made decisions to incorporate something like the skate stuff, or when you started selling reggae, did you see a visible change in the culture of the shop, in the people that were coming in?
Well, with the skate stuff, definitely, yes. Because it was, I suppose, yes, it was quite a different, although they were buying punk records, I suppose it was quite a different culture. So after we started bringing in, I'll just fill you in on the rest of the story, after we started bringing in skateboards and Thrasher from the West Coast, we eventually opened a shop in Covent Garden, which was Slam City Skates.
Yeah.
It was in the basement of Talbot Road, and then we opened the shop in Neil's Yard that was just skateboards with the music downstairs. And that used to be, again, crazy busy, but also good, I mean, really good fun. And then we started bringing in, we started distributing various labels and, you know, various skateboard labels and snowboard labels and clothing labels. We used to do the Beastie Boys, you know, extra large it was. We used to sell all their stuff for them. We still have a really close relationship with the Beastie Boys even to this day. And in fact, they played in the basement of Neil's Yard one time, which is just like a crazy, crazy day.
And
you can see the film on the internet of it. It's such good fun. But you know, you want to reach out to as many people as possible, really, don't you? I think all the time. I mean, I suppose we're not great, I think, at the moment. I mean, we sell, you know, quite a lot of hip hop and grime and stuff, but we don't really reach the more underground audience, I have to say, at the moment, really.
It's difficult. Do you think that's become more difficult? Do you think there is less chance to do that because of social media kind of taking that space?
Yeah, maybe that's, I don't know, maybe that's the reason, I suppose. And I do know that however much we want to sell, you know, all sorts of music, I think that people still see us as, people still come in thinking we only sell Rough Trade records, you know, and whereas we sell everything across the board. Funny enough, I think we have been selling quite a lot of mainstream stuff the last few years. I mean, things like Sigrid, you know, we had, you know, events with Sigrid, which were really popular. So I suppose we're reaching out that way, but maybe towards the more undergroundy sort of things, areas is a bit harder, I guess.
And you mentioned, for example, opening Slam City Skates shop, but obviously there's been quite a few shops that opened since you taken on that first one in 1982. What was the most difficult part of that growth process?
I suppose it's scale, really. it's very hard to make a small shop just selling records work. And I think it was only after our lease came up in Neil's yard, and the shop there was quite small, two floors quite small, and the new rent was, you know, really high. So we started looking for a different area. So we looked in East End around Shoreditch. We found where we are now, Rough Trade East. We found for the same amount of money as Covent Garden, this is what we could get, this big shop, which is what we've always wanted, a big shop with a cafe. We'd always sort of hankered after that, and we, you know, managed to get it and get it going. It took us, I think, a good 2 years to understand how to make a shop like that work, because, you know, going from a tiny shop to a big shop like that, especially at the time of, there's a lot of things then not on vinyl still. So I can remember the PJ Harvey album coming out, and I thought we'd racked it out so everybody could see, you know, where it was, but it was no vinyl on that release day. And so the CD, it's very hard to make a visual impact with that. I can remember somebody coming in saying, oh, have you got the new PJ Harvey? And I was thinking, yeah, it's everywhere. But of course, it's very hard to sort of make an impact with it. So that was a lesson we had to learn very quickly. It's always been a tough old world. I mean, we used to have a shop in Paris, which opened at the time of Air and Dimitri. So it was a very fashionable sort of time. We used to sell, it used to be really busy. But then it kind of went off the boil a bit, and the people there were kind of shrugged their shoulders in that kind of Parisian way and said, well, we can only, you know, we can't sell rubbish records to, you know, normal people. They can only sell cool records to cool people, which was, you know, really frustrating. So we had to close it in the end. You know, you have to, it's hard. You have to keep, you know, spinning all those plates at once. It's hard.
I think it's important to mention, though, because it's very easy for people to look at a company like Rough Trade that has got so many years of culture involved with it and think that it's easy sailing, not know anything of what goes on behind the scenes, right?
Yeah, it's not easy sailing at all. You have to be really sort of focused all the time. You cannot afford to take your eye off the ball at all. You know, you've got to stay close to your customers. You've got to hear what they're asking for. At the same time, you've got to, you know, give them what they want. It's a kind of a virtuous circle, I suppose. I mean, the thing, I don't work in the shop as much as I'd like to these days, but you know, you can hear what people are asking for and what's going down well in the shop. It's very hard to you know, get it right, I think. You just have to make sure you keep your ear to the ground. And I have to say, I don't look on the internet too much about what's going on, because I find it all a bit fluffy sometimes. And I think there might be this kind of huge sort of, you know, something's gone viral, but it's like for a day and it's not real. Whereas I think in the shop, if you get just a few people asking for a new record by so-and-so, you kind of know that that's going to be an important record. Or, you know, you play something in the shop and like three people come up and say, oh, what's this? This is really good. Then you kind of, you can understand that. You think, oh, actually, that is real and people are actually liking that, whereas on the internet sometimes it can just be a bit, you know, a few people like it but actually customers don't like it, or, you know, punters don't like it.
Yeah, what would you say is a record that has done quite well in the store recently that's kind of unexpected, not the ones we're listening to on the radio?
Oh, blimey. Let me have a think about that one. We'll come back to that one, okay?
Yeah, that's okay.
No, actually, I will tell you. I think one that has not surprised me, I mean, I suppose there's two, actually, I can talk about. So there's Max Richter and Sleep. So that was this was a couple of years ago. It was our album of the month and one of our top 10 albums of the year. But I know his manager, and I knew he had a new record coming. He did this amazing record called Blue Notebooks, which was just fantastic, modern composition thing. And so about 18 months before Sleep was ready, or maybe a year before Sleep was ready, I said, look, we really want to work with you on this one. We want it to be Album of the Month, blah, blah, blah. So we booked it all in. And at the time, that whole Niels Frahm, Max Richter modern composition thing was very, you know, it's very low key, but we just kind of hit the wave at the right time. And in the end, I think Sleep was our best selling record of the year, really, when it came out. And even though we'd booked it, you know, like a year before it came out, and it's just trying to hit the wave at the right time. And the other one I'd say was Idols. I mean, we booked that in, and who'd have thought that, you know, like a punk band from Bristol
would, yeah.
You know, when we booked that in and started getting behind that, that was, they weren't that big news. But I tell you, that when their album came out, Captain Brutalism came out, we did in stores all round, its album of the month. I think we sold 5,000 records in that first week. And now, you know, they're selling, you know, selling out Ali Pali in, you know, 6 hours or something. It's incredible. And, you know, you wouldn't have thought, you know, they've been played on the radio a bit, but suddenly things all come together. And it's not necessarily what you think. It's, I suppose, you know, I suppose we help in that process of getting, you know, things onto the radio. I guess with Fontaine's DC this year, it's our album of the year, but it's also Radio 6's album of the year. And I guess I suppose where we go, other people follow it. And that's what we always try and do, I guess.
The other thing I wanted to touch on is you mentioned, for example, the Paris store. When there's situations within the business where things don't go the way you want them, what would your advice be on how to deal with something like that?
Well, I think it's like anything really, you know, one door closes, another door opens. I mean, when we shut the Paris shop, you know, they owed us a lot of money, and we got to the point where we had to decide whether to give them more money or had to stop and, you know, move on. So in the end, we had to stop and move on. And at the time, you know, in fact, we didn't have much choice. The bank told us we had to. They owed us a lot of money, and it meant that we had to kind of reevaluate and look at things again. And, you know, it meant it in a couple of years after that, we opened the shop in East London. You just have to see things. You just have to move on. You just have to learn from them and make sure you don't make the same mistakes again, and learn and move on, really.
And it's interesting because obviously those mistakes or things that go wrong don't define you in any way. No one remembers. It's not the thing that they remember about Rough Trade, is it? They remember the new store, not the one that closed down.
Hopefully, yeah. So, you know, touch wood, we've never made any huge mistakes where people remember us by, God, I hope we never do.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, I mean, it's just one of those. It was just one of those things. It was a shame. We also had a shop in Japan, and that was... we had to shut that one. No, that's not our call. That was the guy we were working with there. His wife died, and I think he just wanted to move on, really. It's a real shame. It's a lovely shop, and we had to move on from that.
How about Record Store Day? How has that affected how you work as a company?
Well, it's an amazing event, I have to say. I mean, we love it. It's a really hard work, but we try and make it kind of fun. And it's not just about, you know, getting those records, but it's about fun. So we try and have lots of interesting bands playing. They don't have to be big bands. They just have to be interesting. And we try and have, you know, face painting, just stuff like that. It has become, I mean, I think there's danger of it becoming a bit too about sort of major labels putting out records that, you know, nobody really wants. So it's about getting the right balance. I know in America... They have a committee who chooses what can come out on Record Store Day, which I think is, you know, wrong. I think people should put out what they want to put out on Record Store Day. If it sells, great, and if it doesn't, it doesn't. It just takes up so much time to get it organised and set up. And it also, I mean, it's our busiest day of the year by far, obviously, but it's just such a great day. I mean, it's just such great fun. We had last year at West, this year at West, we had Fontaines playing outside the shop. And they came down, they were playing in Leeds the night before, and they drove down from Leeds to play outside the shop for 20 minutes in the hail. And then they drove back up to Manchester for a gig that night. I mean, that, yeah, to me, I mean, that's what Record Store Day is all about. You know, people just doing that bit extra, you know, shops, bands, you know, we're trying to give something back, but at the same time, obviously, we're selling lots of records, but
of course,
you know, but it's just making it fun and exciting, I think. I mean, it does tie up pressing plants for, you know, 3 months or something,
yeah.
But I don't really have much time for people who say it's a bad thing, because it gets people into shops, into our, you know, all record shops, apart from HMV, which I know they're sort of, you know, they want to be part of it, but I don't think they should be. So, yeah, no, it's about making it, you know, making it fun again, I guess.
No, it's interesting, the HMV thing, because yeah, I agree. I don't think they should be part of it. And the big reason for that is what we were talking about before. You go to a record store to get recommendations from people who care about what they're recommending.
Yeah.
And there isn't that culture at somewhere like HMV. That doesn't exist there generally.
No, I'm sure there are people who work in HMV who do love music and are helpful. But I suppose the whole culture of HMV is so different to sort of Rough Trade or Piccadilly or Resident, you know, or Drift. It's completely different to that, isn't it, really? I don't know.
If you had to leave our listeners with a thought to take away from this conversation, what would it be? What do you think is important to leave people with?
Oh, my God.
Just to put you on the spot. You
know? Yeah, no, exactly, yes. I mean, if you love music, which I do, I mean, there's always stuff out there to be discovered, I think. And that's the thing. I think when people get to a certain age, you think, oh, there's nothing good or new out there. But actually, there's loads of great bands, great records, great music out there. And that's what I would say is, you know, you go into your local shop and ask behind the counter and see what they've got for you.
Yeah, I think that's a great message. And I think that's what we need in the music culture is that connection to actually go and pick the records up, look at the sleeves again, read all the inside notes. That's such a big part of music for me.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Nigel, I have really, really enjoyed talking to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, no, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for checking out that episode of the podcast. I had such a wonderful time talking to Nigel. I find the whole story so fascinating, and I hope you did too. If you enjoyed that episode, you might also enjoy my episode with Sean McGowan. We talk about his touring with Billy Bragg and the Levellers, as well as just tour life in general. Also, my episode with Ricky Bates, who runs The Joiners, which is, for me, another legendary music venue in the UK, is absolutely wonderful. And also my one with Kelly Kemp, who's a musician, but also is involved in co-ops and is involved in the Kurdistan solidarity campaigns for Portsmouth. So that's an absolutely wonderful conversation that I found absolutely fascinating. There's so many more. I recently talked to Pete from Ducking Punches, a great UK band as well, about yoga and touring and keeping healthy both physically and mentally whilst on tour. So yeah, if you enjoyed this episode and you are a new listener, there is hopefully a whole load more for you to discover, and I look forward to hearing what you think. Again, thanks for listening, and catch you next time.
Shows that we had at Neil's Yard. So we recorded all those on mini disc, and I think we've got Jeff Buckley, you know, PJ Harvey, people like that, all on mini disc somewhere. But I don't know what we're going to do with them.